Welcome to Ordinarily Extraordinary Conversations with Women in STEM. I'm your host, Kathy Nelson, an electrical engineer who loves to hear and share stories of other women in STEM. Today, I'm joined by Sinian Klongkla Sikozana, who recently received her PhD in astronomy and astrophysics. She also has degrees in applied mathematics and physics. She's from South Africa and shares her experience of going from a small village in South Africa to being an astronomer and astrophysicist, and how she uses outreach so little girls in these smaller villages can see themselves in similar careers. Please enjoy her story.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I am good. It's good to see you today.
So I was attending sort of like a winter school. That we are going through like data analysis workshops and working on tutorials. And now, like under the normal circumstances, you'd actually travel to the place and so just focus on the winter school. But now due to it being online, like you're attending and doing like a million other stuff at the same time.
Well, have you found that you have just gotten tired of everything being on the computer?
Yeah, I'm tired. I'm exhausted. I'm exhausted.
You're in South Africa. How have things been? Because I haven't heard great things about how things are in South Africa, but I'm curious from your actual standpoint versus what we hear. How are things going there, like COVID-wise?
So I think we started off really well in terms of like our lockdown started really early. So like only after a few cases were reported, like the country went on lockdown and like the restrictions were really harsh. But because it was done early, like we were able to control the situation. But then as things went by, like as the country sort of returned to normal, like the lockdown has never been lifted absolutely. So we have like different levels. And at each level, like there's different activities that you can do. And so I think of late, the government has been really sort of reactional, and the reaction has come like a bit late. So the scientists would like warn that there's a wave coming, like now we're in the third wave. So they'd be like, there is a wave coming, and with the Delta variant, it's probably going to be like hectic. And the government will like literally adjust the regulations like too late so that we still like feel the heavy impact. And I guess one thing they've also not done very well is the vaccination. It's very slow. So currently only the frontline workers have been vaccinated and people over the age of 60. And currently they're also vaccinating educators. So those are the only people that can be or have been vaccinated.
It's probably going to be a while before you guys start getting back to a little bit of sense of normalcy and being able to have a little bit of, you know, life back and seeing people. And
yeah, it's going to be a while. Like I'm probably thinking maybe next year if things are able to be controlled. It's going to be some time.
You just recently got your PhD. So congratulations. That's so awesome.
Thank you.
And okay, I gotta start with like, okay, so I love physics and math. And okay, so your PhD is in astronomy and astrophysics, right? And then you have bachelor's and master's degrees in applied mathematics and bachelor's and master's degrees in applied mathematics and physics.
Sorry, just a bit of correction. So my bachelor's my bachelor's degree is in applied mathematics and pure physics. And then when I continued further, so like my postgrad, honors, masters, and PhD is like applied mathematics. So I continued with the applied mathematics stream.
Okay. There's so many things I want to ask you. I'm not even sure where to start. Okay. So what is applied mathematics versus mathematics? Like what's the differentiation between that?
Okay. So the way I have understood it and usually explain it is, so there's the sort of pure mathematics, which is usually a very abstract orientated and like based on the theories. So it's like the fundamentals of mathematics, like the building blocks of mathematics. So you like understanding mathematics at a very fundamental level. However, with applied mathematics, you are then using those mathematical theories and applying them to real life scenarios. So for example, you can study like some biology related topic, maybe like the spread of bacteria or something, or apply it to like astronomy, like how fast the stars rotate, or what happens when particles like disperse when there's a supernova. So you're using those mathematical laws and applying them to real life scenarios.
I don't totally know what astrophysics is. I think I have an idea of what astronomy is, but I'm assuming it's probably also different when you're studying it than it is what I think of astronomy, which is like, oh, look, there are the star formations that we learned about. So what is astrophysics? And then what is astronomy from a standpoint of like what you study?
So astronomy is like the umbrella. So everything falls sort of like under astronomy. And then within astronomy, you have like different research focuses. So for example, there's what we call cosmology, which, you know, talks about the Big Bang theory, which is like the evolution of the universe on a large scale. So that would be like cosmology. And then with astrophysics, you're concerned more about like the physics that is taking place in the universe. So for example, what happens when a star bursts? Like what is the particle interaction that takes place when you have like a supernova explosion? So you're applying the physics within that scenario. So like for example, for my project, I study like galaxy clusters, but I'm more concerned about like the particles within the galaxy cluster. So there's photons that are emitted because of the electrons within that environment. So just basically the physics of the astrophysical celestial objects, yes.
Okay, so you talk about like what you studied, and I'm assuming this is when you were doing your PhD. How do you study that? Because it's, I mean, how do you study other galaxies?
Okay, so like I usually, when I have like outreach initiatives, like I usually have a slide where I say the universe is our laboratory, and which is true, but because the universe is so large, like I can't go to another galaxy and like physically study the galaxy. And so what we do is that we use instruments, telescopes that observe the universe at different wavelengths. So for example, you have optical telescopes that observe the universe at an optical wavelength. And then basically what you see in that wavelength is what we see with your naked eye. And then you have like radio wavelengths and like higher energies like X-ray and so on. So what we basically do is that we use those instruments to basically collect the information about the universe. So we basically collect the photons using these instruments and then sort of like convert that signal and digitize it and then create images that we then analyze of those objects. So like an object that is so far away, we are able to collect the photons, make images, and then analyze the object.
What's the most interesting thing that you've seen in your studies, in your research?
So I think for my research, so one of the telescopes that I was using is basically what we call Meerkat, which is a South African instrument, which is a precursor to the SKA, which is like the currently the biggest project within radio astronomy. And so we use the Meerkat telescope to observe what we call the bullet cluster, which is like a very interesting cluster where basically the first people to observe it or to study it actually saw or like had an indirect detection of what we call dark matter, which is like the missing matter particles that we aren't able to like physically see. And so we collected observations of that data set, and it was quite interesting because many studies have been done on it, and because of the sensitivity of the MEERKAT telescope, we're actually starting to see like interesting processes that were previously not reported.
So what did you do your dissertation on? Like, what was like the focus of your research within your PhD and dissertation?
Okay, so the title of my project was Diffuse Radio Emission in Actpol Clusters. And I'll just break that down to sort of expand on what my research was focused on. So Actpol is basically a telescope that's in Chile, the Atacama Cosmology Telescope. And it basically observes the sky, and then it actually collects information about the galaxy clusters. So basically also, I guess to relay, our galaxy is the Milky Way, and then that galaxy actually lives within a group of other galaxies, and these galaxies are bound by gravity. And so that group of galaxies bound by gravity is what we call a galaxy cluster. And so the Atacama Cosmology Telescope actually observes these galaxy clusters. And then the science that we are interested in is basically what happens when two of these objects collide. So just to give an approximate size, they basically sort of like 10 to the 15 times larger than the mass of our own sun. So they're like the very big objects. And so when they collide, they release tons of energy. So there's lots of energy released into what we call the plasma that is between these galaxies. And what we were interested in finding is, so when this energy is dispersed, it is then injected in the plasma that is between the clusters. And because it is injected there, and there's like electrons and all these particles within the plasma, they then get re-accelerated to very high energies. And because they accelerated to really high energies, and then within the system, you also have magnetic fields, you then have what we call synchrotron emission. So basically, as these electrons spiral along, they emit photons. And so it's these photons that we were interested in studying. And how we studied them is we collected them using radio telescopes. And so the telescope I was using is the MEERKAT that I've mentioned. And then there's also a telescope that's based in India, which is called the GMRT, which is the Giant Meter Wave Radio Telescope. And so the aim of my project was that we observe about 30 of these clusters, these big objects that we detect using the Actpol. And our aim was to study the environments that actually give rise to the release of these photons. And by studying this, we are in essence sort of studying how these objects evolve over time. And so we're also getting to understand the physics that happens on those scales, because there's still like a lot of questions as to how these electrons actually travel and how they actually move from one point to another, or even actually what produces these electrons. So basically we were trying to understand that using a sample of about 30 of these galaxy cluster objects.
Do you actually see them collide, or do you see like the after effects and so you see that they have collided? Like, how do you know that there's a collision?
That's a very interesting question. And so basically, this research can be done in two ways. So the first is where you basically target objects that you know that there has been a collision. And how you can know that is that you use data from other wavelengths. So like optical wavelength or X-ray wavelength will tell you if there has been this collision. And so like if you use that data, so you know there has been that collision, and then you point the telescope there. Or you can just blindly follow any of these objects, maybe like based on how heavy they are, and then just see if within the sample that you have, if there are those that there has been a collision in, and what is the effects that you see then, or in those that there hasn't been a collision in, how different it is from the one that you actually know that there's a collision. So in my project, we actually blindly followed. So it wasn't that we knew there was a collision, but because we see the after effects, we're like, okay, here there was a collision. And then in the ones that there was no collision, how different are they from each other?
What is a radio telescope? Okay, so I'm a telecom engineer, so I do understand radio waves. I don't understand how they would like relate to a telescope.
So here in South Africa, we have what we call a dish, a DSTV dish, which is basically a dish that you install and then to basically connect to different channels in your TV, right? So it's like a dish that's parabolically shaped and then it collects the waves and then connects you to different channels, right? So using the same concept, the radio telescope is then most of the time parabolically shaped, and then what it does is that it collects radio waves. So photons that are at radio wavelengths, it then collects them, and then what we do is that the telescope then has what we call a back end, where the signal is then digitized. So these radio waves are then digitized and then translated into like a data format that we then analyze.
How big are these telescopes that you're talking about? So, okay, here's my like world of telescopes. So I bought my son a telescope a few years ago. It was like $100. He could see like I think we could see like the moon a little bit bigger. So I'm just gonna guess here that this is like a much, much, much larger, much, much, much more expensive telescopes that you're talking about.
Yeah, they're definitely very expensive and much larger. So like within the radio astronomy field, you can have what we call a single dish telescope, and then you can have what we call an interferometer. So a single dish can be as big as like 100 meters in diameter. So that's approximately like the
Oh,
size of a football field
yeah.
in diameter.
That's
So
huge.
that's really huge. So that's like a single dish radio telescope. But then with an interferometer, you can sort of like break it down to smaller dishes, but then you like connect them in a back end to form like one telescope. So like with interferometers, like the Meerkat is like 13 meters in diameter. So much smaller in size, but then you actually have like around 60 of these antennas forming like a bigger telescope.
So is it almost kind of like a combiner? So you're taking all these different signals and putting them together?
And multiplying them together, yes. So that's basically how we form like a bigger telescope using smaller dishes.
Okay. So are these telescopes, because I mean, I guess when I maybe have seen them on TV or pictures, so are these like up in the mountains or I mean, and these are in like deserted places, right? Like where people aren't around and stuff. So like, so you talk about like the meerkat. So I'm a little bit familiar with South Africa. So like where in South Africa does the meerkat telescope exist?
So it's basically in a province called the Northern Cape, and you're absolutely correct. It's usually like in isolated environments and like deserts most of the time. And so, for example, I mentioned the SKA, which is the Square Kilometer Array, which South Africa won a bid to host alongside Australia. And the reason why this like leading telescope in the world was chosen to be hosted in South Africa was because of the condition of where the Meerkat telescope is, which is the Northern Cape. And this is because it had like low radio frequency interference. And basically what that is like all the signal that we do not want to detect. So for example, if you go on site with a cell phone, your telephone, because these instruments are so sensitive, they'll they'll pick up that signal. Like if there's a microwave somewhere there, because this instrument is so sensitive, it'll actually pick up the signal. And so we actually want it to be in isolated places so that we don't have these fake signals or these signals that we are not interested in.
Yeah, so basically you're trying to get rid of or trying to be in an environment that has no interference.
Exactly, exactly. Or interference that is known, because like there's some that we can't prevent. So like the space telescopes that sort of like go around orbiting the Earth, that we can't avoid, or like airplanes we can't avoid. But what we can do is that we model the signal so that we can be able to remove it from the observations.
Okay. So what got you interested in this? In studying this and studying astronomy and astrophysics?
I think from a very young age, I was very inquisitive. So like I always knew that I want to be part of like some groundbreaking discovery. So just to give you a background, I'm originally from a village in the province of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. And like where I grew up, we used to like herd cattle in the field, and like we'd have so many fun activities and discoveries that we'd make along the trips that we'd have. And so that like sort of at a very young age got me interested in like discoveries and things that you learn basically. And so that's where I was like, okay, I definitely want to be part of these people that discover new things basically. But I wasn't really exposed to astronomy as a career until I was in what we call grade 12, which is the final year of our high school. And so that is when we basically were invited to our local university. That's where I actually got introduced to the opportunity of having of being an astronomer or having an astronomy as a career, because you know, when I was in high school, the sort of careers that we were exposed to were like, you're going to be a lawyer, an accountant, an engineer, or a medical doctor. Like, yeah, my parents really wanted me to be a medical doctor, my family actually. So those are the kind of careers that you are exposed to. But like in high school, I really enjoyed mathematics and physics. And so when I learned that there's a career that actually combines both and you get to study space and all the things that are out there, I was like, okay, I'm doing that. I'm definitely doing that. So it was after attending that career guidance workshop that I actually decided that I will go into the astronomy field.
Okay, so you said that your parents wanted you to be a medical doctor. What was their reaction when you said that you wanted to be an astronomer?
They were like, what is that? What are you going to be doing for a living? And how much are you going to be earning? So,
well, yeah. Okay. So to be honest, I'm curious too, because I don't know what a job is as an astronomer, right? I mean, like, so what is a job as an astronomer?
Basically what I do is I sit in front of my laptop most of the time and basically write codes to process data. So basically that is what we mainly do, is that, as I said, so the first step would be like writing proposals to these telescopes and telling them that I'm interested in these objects and I'd really like to observe them. So that's one part of what we do, writing proposal. And then when that proposal is accepted, and then you get the data, then you sort of write, like, so there's a lot of computer programming involved. You write code to basically analyze that data. Make images from that data. And then after that, you then sort of like extract the physics from the images. So I spend most of my time in front of a computer or a laptop, or use,
as most of us do. Exactly. It just depends on what you're looking at, right?
Exactly. But I guess the fun part, which I guess got them convinced as well, is that we travel to conferences a lot and we get to go to really nice places and meet people from all over the world. And that has definitely been a highlight of mine as well, and what I miss during these COVID times. So yes, I guess that's also one aspect as well, going to conferences or like international meetings and basically presenting your research to an international crowd.
What a job as an astronomer, would that typically be within like a university setting, like doing research, or what kind of a setting or company would you typically be working in or for?
So as an astronomer, it can either be a university, as you said, so you can choose to go the academic route. And so if you choose that, usually it's not just you doing research, you also of course have to do some teaching and so on. So that's basically what you'd be doing. Otherwise, you can also work for a research institute. So for example, here in South Africa, since we have the Meerkat telescope, we also have what we call the South African Radio Astronomy Observatory. And basically there, your job will be purely based on research. So basically work as like a commissioning scientist, so purely based on astronomy research. So it's either you go the academic route or basically just a work for a research institute. But that's if you decide to stay in astronomy. Like there's a lot of colleagues that have actually branched off to various fields. Like I mentioned that we do a lot of programming. So there's been a lot of like software developers. Like if you choose to go to a different institute or choose a different career either than astronomy. So like there are other colleagues in like financing institutions as well. So there's quite a lot that you can do with a PhD in astronomy.
So you talked about when you were young that you lived in a village that and herded cattle. What was your life like growing up in this village? And were you able to, I mean, and you talked about, you know, not, you know, thinking about astronomy as a career, which quite honestly, I didn't either. Were you able to see yourself like in science, in math? Like what did like your culture and your environment that you grew up in, did women typically work outside the home, or what was that kind of like your cultural setting that you were growing up in? What was that like?
So I guess there's many aspects that we can touch on when it comes to that part of my life. But I guess what I was really fortunate to have is an environment that really encouraged me to sort of like think outside of society norms. So for example, as you mentioned, it was a village setting. And so the history of village settings, well, within South Africa, was that usually the mother would stay behind and look after the kids or the family, while the father goes and works like in the city, be it like in factories or mines and so on. So the norm was that the woman would stay and look after the family. However, my mother is actually a primary school teacher. And so even though my father was working outside of a village and was working like far from home, my mother actually also chose to have like a career. And also I was so fortunate to have a grandmother who was also so liberated. And so even though she herself was not educated and didn't have these opportunities, she was like, I want my grandchildren to like flourish, to do things that I was never able to. And so because I grew up in that environment, I never sort of like limited myself in terms of like what girls can or can't do. And unfortunately, like society was still catching on in the sense that like even when I went, I was in my undergraduate, like there was a point in my second year in a module where I was like the only female in a physics module, like the whole university second year. And so although I grew up from that environment, externally there were those challenges that Yeah, some people still think that this is a kind of field that is for certain people, reserved for a certain gender. However, because my environment was so cultivating, I was actually able to think beyond society norms.
Okay, so let me ask you about your college experience, because I think that's interesting. And so as an engineer, there weren't a lot of women in my classes either. But I also didn't come from a village where, most women stayed behind. So did you find, like, within your professors and within, your fellow students, did you find any kind of, like, biases against you, or did people embrace you and, want you to succeed, or did you have some challenges in there as well?
So I think in terms of the lecturers or the environment, it was very embracing. So I think I was fortunate in so many ways. Like there's so many students that didn't have the privileges I had. And so this is because when I started in my first year, after going to the career guidance talk I mentioned before, I actually applied for a scholarship. And I actually, because I matriculated with the marks that they were looking for, I actually got that scholarship. And now what that scholarship afforded me was that when I started my first year, I was actually attached to a mentor, which
Oh.
was like a professor already in astronomy. And so throughout my undergrad years, I always had that support structure from my mentor, someone who was so advanced in the field. And so because of that, I always had like backup and like encouragement. However, what I will tell you that was lacking was like because there were so few women, it was very hard to see myself in the field in terms of like I couldn't relate with people in the field. And so for example, like one comment that was made when I was like transitioning to postgrad was that I shouldn't think of marriage or having children until I do like two postdocs. And then only then I can think about something like that. And now because of the cultural background I had, I was like, is this really going to work for me? Like, is this the kind of career that I really want to be in? And so I get that was the struggle that I had, like seeing myself in the people that taught me or in the people that were guiding me throughout my career.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I hear that a lot. That you know, whether it's medicine or, something, basically something, when you get into these, like, very, very advanced degrees, that you have to focus so much on your career that you can't have a family and you can't have a life. I mean, that's almost what it is. Like, you can't have a life outside of what you're studying and what your career and your, academics is. But I think, I guess, in my mind, and maybe tell me what you think about this, but I think part of something that I think is important for us to do, and that I think that, women bring, when we talk about diversity and stuff, is redefining those norms. Why is that normal? And, whether you're male or female, you should be able to have a family and a life and a career, right? And I don't even think of it as, I think, like, in, like, I mean, I so I grew up in the 80s, and there was this, like, having it all, and, like, super mom and stuff. But I don't even think that it's that. It's having, I mean, we talk about work-life balance, and I don't really like that term either. But it's more of being able to structure your career, your job, and your life in a way that works for you, without having it have to be this way, like, having it to be all-encompassing one way or another. And I think that that's something that, hopefully, and I'm pretty sure we're not anywhere near there, but I hope that that's something that, that women can bring through, through this diversity, is having that true balance versus it having to be so lopsided.
Man, that's so true. Like, just to add to what you said, like, for me, having a family or like seeing people in these roles, what like was really so important to me in such a way that whenever I attended conferences and I would see women in the field, like I'll ask them questions like those were comfortable with sharing, would share. And like this other female who was a postdoc, I was a master's student then, No, I was as just starting my PhD. She mentioned something to me that like really stuck with me and sort of redefined how I thought of my career. She was like, I chose to have a family, and that meant sacrificing some of the things within my academic career. But for me, having that really made me happy. It is what I really wanted. And because it's what I wanted, I do not mind missing out on those publications or that high age index and whatnot. So it's all about what you as an individual value and what you as an individual deem to make you happy or like find joy in, instead of like having this rigid structure that it's like either this way or the highway, but like sort of define what it is that you want as an individual. And I think it's going to take some time for us to get there.
For sure. I do hope though that at some point it's not the norm for you to be able to move up or to be able to, you know, have the career that you want or be able to be in the position that you want, that you have to work 60 or 80 hours a week, because that's not healthy no matter what your gender is. And I think there needs to be some redefinition as to, you know, what defines a, I don't want to say a successful career, but being able to, you know, still have those contributions to the world and to society and to your field without having it be 80 hours a week. And maybe at some point in your life, it is 80 hours a week, right? Because you have, you know, your kids are grown, you're, you know, there's times that, you know, I think you can have that focus, but I don't feel like it should be so career limiting that, you know, you miss out on being able to advance to things and be able to contribute because you know, have a family. And I don't think that it's necessarily gender specific. I know that, you know, generally most of like a lot of that does fall on women, which I think that's a whole nother discussion, but, but I think that there just needs to be some, there just needs to be some redefinition into what is, you know, success and, you know, how to be able to advance regardless of what field you're in. It's, I think it's, I guess it's just, it's not healthy and it's not, I don't know. There's just a lot of problems that I see with it.
That's true. Like at the end, no one really gains anything, because like when you're really overworked and exhausted, like what is it that you gain at the end of it all? So right. I think, yeah, adjusting or like redefining the success measure would be really important.
Yeah, and hopefully at some point we get there. I you're right, it's going to take an absolutely a long time, because it's redefining, you know, societal norms that have been in place for probably hundreds of years.
I hope you're enjoying this podcast and Cindy and Claw's story. If you enjoy the podcast and would like to support it, head over to your favorite podcast platform where you can rate it, or even better, write a review, which will help other people find my podcast and bring these women's stories to more listeners. You can also find me, Kathy Nelson, at www.ordinarily-extraordinary.com. Thanks, and back to Cindy and Claw's story.
You talked about doing outreach. What kind of outreach do you do? And do you go into like the types of villages that you grew up in so that you can be that representation to girls in kind of the same situation that you grew up in?
That's true. It's exactly that. So my outreach initiatives are usually educational based. So whether it's like just going to villages or townships and talking about career opportunities in astronomy, or actually I've also been involved with the project, which is basically run by the college, where we take these students that are from these villages or from these isolated areas who probably have never been exposed to many of the science careers, and we invite them to the university and basically expose them to what we do. And so it's basically all about broadening the mind of those who might not be so accustomed to the many various science careers that one can go into. And the reason, as you mentioned, why I'm so passionate about this is because for me, that representation or that person I could totally relate to was not there. And so like what I definitely make a point when I do go out to these places is that I'm very engaging and I'm sort of like the person that they can relate to and not the scientist that they have in mind that, oh no, this is what a scientist looks like. A scientist is always stern and like she doesn't have time for anything else. And so I just sort of try to shift their mind on how they think a scientist should be like or should even look like.
So basically the scientists are people. And that we have personalities and that we have lives.
And we have lives outside of our computers and pile of textbooks.
Yes. So true. I have been to South Africa a couple of times, and the area that I have been to, well, so I actually talk about going to, you know, faraway places and conferences and stuff. And honestly, like one of my favorite places that I have been to for a conference was actually South Africa. My daughter spent 3 months doing some mission work in a small village outside of Cape Town. And then by some, I want to say like miraculous divine intervention, I ended up going to Cape Town shortly after she was there, brought her with me. I got to meet the kids that she worked with, her host family. And then I ended up going back a couple of years later. The area that she worked in, so I don't know if I said it's Ocean View, which is about 40 minutes outside of Cape Town. And I don't know, you know, so this is my small piece of South Africa that I have been in. It's a mixed race community. There's a lot of gang violence, a lot of drug addiction, and the work that like this guy who is from there that he does is basically to try to, he uses sports and soccer. So he was like a semi-professional soccer player. And so he was kind of able to like lift himself out of this, you know, poverty situation that he was in. And, you know, trying to work to give these boys that are in the village a positive male role model. I do see the girls being a little bit left behind. I mean, they do some like soccer things with them. But one of the things that I found interesting, and I don't know if this is because of South African culture or because of the kind of, it's not like an inner city area, but it's kind of like there's almost these like inner city problems of like gangs and drugs and stuff that, but one of the things that I thought was interesting the last time I was there, the guy who does this work asked my daughter, and she was there with a friend who she had done her mission work with, was to talk with one of the girls was thinking about dropping out of school. She was 15. She was planning to get married and basically start a family at like 15. And he's like, can you talk, you know, just talk to her about what you can do and stuff like that. So I'm curious, is that something that you see like in the villages that, you know, girls at very young ages drop out of school in general to, you know, start families? And so it's not just like this thing of like being able to represent what you can do, but almost like shifting the cultural norm to, you don't have to do this and you can have a, you know, a different life that is, you know, not so poverty ridden. And I'm not saying that the villages are, I'm just saying this was like the, you know, the situation that I saw. I'm just curious if that's typical or if that was like situational for this, like possibly like one area that I just happened to be in.
The thing about South Africa is that it's very unequal. And so in some parts, so like if you go to Cape Town, for example, or the city Durban that I currently stay in, it is so advanced. And like the thinking is also so advanced. Like you have like these highly independent women who like just owning it for themselves. However, as you mentioned, then you have the cases where like these villages, for example, where basically for them, what is normal is basically to either go to school until grade 7 or grade 12 and then just get married or start a family. And to them, that is the life they know. That is all there is to life that they are exposed to. And so, as you mentioned, for me, it is also that element of there's so much else out there that you can actually become. Because what I also found is that, like, it's very hard to become what you have never seen. And so because they've never seen, in some instances, like never seen like an independent woman who chooses a career or like who chooses to advance themselves, they're like, okay, this is all there is to life. And that's basically how my life is going to span out as well. And so the more exposure they get to the different types of routes that you can actually take, like to the different academic or, I mean, career paths they are, then that's when they actually get to see that there's more options out there, that they don't have to actually fall into what has been a norm in their own environment. So yes, I guess the case that you mentioned is not an isolated case. And what I have actually seen a progress in, and I acknowledge that there's been improvement, is that the village that I come from, there was actually an instance where they'd actually sort of force girls into marriage in a sense, but the government actually has rules now in that women can refuse such such arrangements, like such marriage arrangements. And so in as much as many things stay the same, there's actually also progress within those isolated or like small villages as well.
So what about from a standpoint, are there opportunities? So if a girl wants to go to university, how hard is that from a standpoint of getting funding? Or in the US, university is ridiculously expensive. And like I have two kids in college right now. They're going into significant debt in order to do it. But how difficult is that in South Africa to be able to afford or be able to have the opportunity to go to university for some of these girls if they were to decide that they wanted to advance their education?
So I guess I'll answer the question in two parts. The first, I'll just directly answer the question you had in that the government has actually come up with a funding scheme, which is called NSFAS. And that's basically a funding scheme where children coming from a certain income bracket can basically apply to this funding scheme. And if you're accepted, so for example, if your parents are just pensioners or only earn up to a certain amount per annum, then you can actually apply. And so in that sense, there has been progress. So you can actually break from that poverty cycle and enter university. However, what I think is a major barrier is the education system within South Africa. Like the hardest part is actually attending schools within the villages and then being able to make it to university, because like the educational system is so restricted, the equipment within the schools and villages is so restricted that by the time you get to grade 12, like you get hardly enough points to actually make it to university. So I guess that's fundamentally where things are actually need to be corrected at the fundamental point, that once they actually can get the points or can actually advance to a point where they are able to enter university, then they can apply. But how do we get them to that point is what is very important currently.
So it's really kind of like upgrading the educational system in the lower levels so that they can be accepted into university.
Exactly.
And I'm assuming that that is probably dependent on where you live, whether you're like, I'm assuming like Cape Town, you probably have like a lot more opportunities to be in environments that provide a better educational opportunities so that your grades are higher and your testing scores or whatever it is that brings you into university.
That is true.
So in the funding that you talked about, I'm curious because racial issues within South Africa are very prevalent. I had a lengthy conversation with a woman when I was going between Cape Town and Amsterdam, and she explained the point system to me, which I wasn't something I was familiar with. Does that play into being able to get scholarships and funding for university as well?
So I guess it does. So how I would explain it is, and how basically they're trying to do is to sort of transform, it's called transformation. And so because, as I mentioned to you, if you're a person of color and you're trying to apply for a scholarship. So for example, let's say you're a person who has been studying in a village, a person of color, and then you're competing for a scholarship with a person who went to a school in the city of Cape Town, like the most expensive school in Cape Town. Like the resources that they're exposed to compared to the resources that you are exposed to are very different. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, then the chances of you getting the scholarship just purely based on the grades would be very low for the person who went to a school in a village. Mm-hmm. And so basically what the government tries, or I guess to a certain extent is trying to do, is to say, okay, we know that there were injustices in our history, and to try to sort of transform the spaces and to try to get these people who previously couldn't even attend such universities to also get similar opportunities. Let's also consider the fact that because of their background, because where they come from, there are disadvantages that will probably cause them to not perform in the same standard as someone who actually went to a very expensive school in Cape Town. And so that's basically sort of the point system, that if you're a person of color, that'd be basically points that we're given on the basis of the history of the country and the background of what you're coming from is.
And so my understanding is if you're mixed race, that then you're kind of like even like more disadvantaged than either being black or white. Is that true? Or did I misunderstand that? Or am I not understanding it in the way that I think that I'm understanding it? Because that's a whole nother layer, right?
Okay. So I guess the laws apply differently to like different institutions. So like I'll talk about what I have personally have like firsthand experience, like with being in like scholarship bodies and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So within the framework of those scholarship bodies, what is defined as black is if you are African, so black as an African, mm-hmm. Indian, South African, Indian, or colored. So colored would be mixed race. So all those three ethnicities are considered as black, and so would be graded in the same manner. And so in that sense, I guess it would be on level ground. But as I say, it's like from the standpoint that I have been exposed to, and I'm not sure if like different institutions actually have different laws when it comes to that.
Interesting. Because like one of the things like my daughter would say when in the area that she was in, like I said, it was mixed race, and she would say that they would have a hard time even getting jobs at McDonald's because being mixed race is just so difficult in South Africa. Because like in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, it was more the community that she was in. Like I was thinking, you know, like when I was there, I'm like, well, can we do something more than just like feed these kids and give them clothes and give them soccer things? Like, how can we fix the systemic issues? And she's like, Mom, like it's so much more than that. Like, it's not, you know, it's this systemic cultural issue that you, that's really, really hard to fix. That's not something that you can go in as, especially as like as an outsider and try to fix. And so I'm like, so it's really like kind of like, that's where my questions are coming from, because I see these girls and like, how could I help these girls get out of these, you know, situations and not be getting married at 15 and stuff. And I realized that, you know, this is just one, you know, pocket. It's just that's probably like more of what my exposure has been.
That's true. I guess like I have like mixed race friends, and sort of what they often feel as a community or as the people that I have spoken to is that like usually the conversations are usually like transformative, like either black or white, like mm-hmm. based on our history. So it's like it's either you're black or you're white, and then they feel like being mixed race, you sort of like get forgotten. It's like you're neither black nor are you actually white, so you don't have the privileges of a white person, but then you're also not a black person, and so the black community doesn't also consider you as one of them, and so because of that, then it also causes these issues as well.
From an outsider's perspective, it's interesting, and we have quite a bit of racism in the US as well. But I was reading, I don't know if it was in Trevor Noah's book or if it was in like when I was watching like one of his, you know, Netflix specials, when he talked about, you guys think that you have racism, we invented racism. it's not something to joke about, but at the same, like, but it's just interesting. Well, and I have to say, I feel in a way like so fortunate to have been able to go there and, you know, meet people and actually be able to be in, you know, not just a tourist, but be able to be in a community. And one of the things I found super interesting, so when I went there with my daughter, and she had, you know, just been there a few months before I went there with her, and she's completely navigating me through Cape Town. And I'm like, Cape Town is like the place that she knows best in the world next to the town that she grew up in. And I'm like, that's so interesting to me. Like, because it's on the other side of the world. And you talk about, you know, like your experiences and, you know, and your parents being excited that you got to go to all these like different places and meet people from all over the place. I have absolutely loved being able to go to South Africa and meet the people that I have there. And it's a beautiful place with some of the most friendly people that I've met. So, okay. So let me transition to that. So what is your favorite place that you have been able to go to?
Oh my goodness. How do I nail it down to one?
Oh, you don't have to nail it down to one. It's hard. I understand that.
So I guess it would have to be, oh my goodness, I'm torn between Mykonos Island, which was in Greece, just because of the scenery and but like we also had a conference in Vietnam, and I met the most amazing people there, and they just were so inviting. I met like a lifelong friend as well. So for me, Vietnam, besides like it was a beautiful city that we went to, and but it was just the people that I met and the friendships that then like transpired from that point onwards. So I guess it would be a tie between Vietnam and Mykonos Island.
I completely feel that too, because I would have a hard time nailing it down as well. I haven't been to Greece. It's on my bucket list. You may have now like made it even like more on my bucket list, because
definitely take it up a notch.
Well, and my daughter and I, so I've taken my kids individually to some place like when they have gotten older. Well, and she's 19 now, and we have been kind of starting to plan a trip to Italy, and we're kind of like debating between Italy and Greece. Now I'm like, maybe we should like rethink Greece, but it needs to be her decision though. So that's kind of where I have to leave that. Cause it's like, okay, she so has to decide. Decisions. Yeah. But I also, so, and Vietnam is on my list. We went to, my family and I 2 years ago, thank goodness we had it planned for 2019 and not 2020. We did a month long trip in Asia, and we went to Japan, Okinawa, Thailand, and Laos. And from being in like that area, Vietnam is very much on my list too, because, you know, I hadn't spent a whole lot of time thinking about it until we were close to it. I'm like, oh, these pictures are beautiful. I'm like, I think we need to go there as well. Like, there's just so many places in the world and so, and not as nearly as much like time and money as you need to see them all.
Definitely, but like what I have loved with traveling is like you like sort of get exposed to cultures and meet people that just change your perspective. Like,
absolutely. Well, okay, so I'm going to confess to something that I find really, really embarrassing, especially talking to someone from Africa. So when I went to South Africa, In my mind, and this is, I think, from, you know, the pictures that I would see in TV in the 80s, I am expecting, you know, villages with like women carrying like big jugs of water. And I know. And I went to this conference, and it was Africa Utilities Week. So I'm an electrical engineer in the utility industry. And I was there actually for a trade association that I chaired. And I met, actually, this I think is super interesting, because as part of this conference, there was a Women in Power and Water luncheon, and the keynote speaker was she was like the head of water and sanitation in, this is like 2017. Now I can't even remember what country she was from. Uganda. Yeah. And, and she had a PhD, and it was a room full of women. And not just that, but I like the women that I met like in the conference, just on the show floor and stuff. And I would talk to them, and we all had the same issues, you know, issues with like, you know, how do you deal with traveling with kids and like all the same things that I deal with. And I'm like, and I've never been to a luncheon that is just women in any conference that I've gone to in engineering before. And it completely changed my viewpoint on what I had in my head of Africa, especially African women. And I was like, oh my, like, and it's so embarrassing, honestly, that I had these stereotypes. And so you're completely right. It breaks down so many viewpoints that you have of people. And I think I live in a very non-diverse area I live in rural Minnesota. There's not a lot of diversity. And I think, you know, so many of the issues and challenges that we have, you know, from like racial standpoints within the US could be broken down just by knowing people in different situations and being able to meet people and talk to people, understand their stories and understand where they're coming from, as long as you have an open mind to do that. And travel, yes, for sure is probably the best way to do that. Except, yes, I also will say that I think it's going beyond, it's getting out of being a tourist. It's, you know, being able to meet people in the communities and being able to, you know, because if you just stay in your hotel and like lay on the beach or something and you're not interacting with people, I don't think that you don't get that, I don't think.
Yeah, that's true. Like, for example, if you come to South Africa and you just go to Sea Point in Cape Town, you do not know South Africa. That is, yeah.
People would tell me when I said that I went to Cape Town, they're like, oh, you didn't go to Africa, you went to Europe.
Exactly. So if you actually make the time to see other places, that's where you actually get to engage with like so the different perspectives within the country and get to hear the stories of the people from those places as well.
Yeah, like I said, like a lot of mine has been from Ocean View, which is only 40 minutes from Cape Town, but it's like it's a completely different world. Like, it's not like Cape Town whatsoever. But then we also did go to Kruger, so we flew up to Kruger and spent a few days there. Which obviously, I mean, that's not really interacting with people either, because that was more about the animals. But it was, I will say, super interesting, like our drive from the airport to the game park, and just seeing the scenery and the lifestyle and stuff on that drive was completely different. Well, it was like 180 degree difference from Cape Town.
That's where you get to pass through villages and
it was really interesting. And so, like I said, so I'm a utility engineer in telecommunications, and I would go by these like I'm gonna call it feet, because so like 4 foot, which would be what, like a little over a meter, shacks, like metal shacks, and they'd have like hand painted on them electricity, airtime, chips, and soda. And I'm like, there is my career right in like one like little shack. because that's exactly what I do, is like communications in the electric space. Maybe not so much the chips and soda, but I thought like it was really interesting.
Lunch.
Exactly. But I loved like what I've seen of South Africa. I've absolutely loved, and I'm, you know, hoping to go back at some point if things open up again.
So, you should visit Durban.
I would like to. I know where it is, where honestly, like probably 5 years ago, I would have had no idea where it is, but yeah. So how do you like Durban? And how far is it from where you grew up? So did you grow up like more on like the northern part of South Africa?
So I grew up in, so KZN is more on the south coast. On the south coast, and the village that I grew up in is basically just further south from Durban, so more on the south part of KZN, yes. And it's about 3 hours away from Durban.
Okay. 3 hours driving?
Driving. 3 hours driving. No.
So what are you most proud of what you've accomplished so far in your life?
I guess this would also be hard to nail down.
Yeah, more than because, one.
I think like at different parts of my life, there are things where I was like, wow. So I think one highlight has to be in 2019, pre-COVID era, I was actually, so there's these events that they have, which is called Lindau Nobel Laureate Meetings. Mm-hmm. So it's like the coolest science meetings ever. So it's hosted in Lindau in Germany. So in 2019, I was part of a team. So basically scientists from South Africa in 2019, I think it was physics. So scientists from South Africa all basically write an application, and then 20 people were selected at that time to actually attend the meeting. So 20 people from the country. And we got to meet like all these Nobel laureates and like Brian Schmidt, like people I've been reading like papers of, like physically. So for me, that was like, wow.
Like the celebrities of your industry, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So I was like, pinch yourself, is it true? Is it happening? So that is definitely a highlight. And I think, I guess, without a doubt, obtaining my PhD. And I think what also made it a highlight was the sort of like the environment under which I had to work towards the end of my PhD. It was like really stressful because it was just after the COVID lockdown. So like the final year of my PhD, where I was supposed to be writing, was when the COVID hit. And then, so I had to work from home. I couldn't see my supervisors every day. Mm. And so like I had to be mentally very strong while also facing so many things. At home, we're quite a big family. And so like the adjusting to the environment and just having to ensure that I see it through. So when it finally happened, I was like, wow, girl, you did that. So I was definitely proud.
Well, it's absolutely awesome. And I have to say, so I saw, I think like the reason that I reached out to you was I saw your posting on LinkedIn and your like, you know, beautiful gown. It's probably not called a gown. It's probably called something else. I don't know, but I love PhD gowns because they're so pretty, and they look so so regal. It's like you look like a queen.
Exactly. With the cushion hat as well. I'm just like, wow. It was amazing.
Yeah, that's so awesome. What do you want to do in your career? Like, what are your aspirations as you go forward?
So I think for me, it's, of course, like I want to stay in academia. I want to, but what I'm really passionate about more is, yes, of course, I love my research and I want to continue producing research, but it is, as you said, trying to make a change wherever I can with the impact that I have. Seeing the journey that I have had and how I'd like it to be different for someone else, like the experiences that I have had. So I actually am currently part of a diversity and inclusion committee within our university, the Astrophysics Research Center. And so for me going forward, it's basically trying to impact where I can. So for the girls that are underrepresented, they don't have to experience sort of like anxiety episodes or like feeling misplaced and whatnot. So if I can, in the smallest way, make an impact in that direction, I would have just achieved what I dream of actually achieving in the future.
Yeah. I think it's so important in being able to, building a community, you know, so that people don't feel alone, that they have, they can find people, whether it's, you know, nearby or honestly around the world. I mean, that's, I think, one of the best things that COVID may have brought is the ability to bring people together, no matter where you are, to not feel alone, though, to not feel like the unique unicorn in a bad way. I think it's good to be a unique unicorn in a good way, but to not be the unique unicorn in a bad way. And, you know, find people you can, you know, say, I went through this, and, you know, and someone else go, yeah, me too. You know, it's, yeah, that's awesome. What advice would you give to a girl or young woman thinking about going into science or STEM or astronomy or astrophysics?
So the advice I would give is, first of all, you have to love science. Like, science is not the kind of field that you go into because you're chasing money. Of course, there is money. No.
Sorry, I must spit out my tea.
I know. No, I hope they don't get me wrong. Yes, you get paid well. But like, if you're chasing money, there are other jobs that you get paid even more, like doing much less. That's how I personally feel. However, like, if you're really passionate, go for it. And I think what also would be important, or what I have seen being important, is be true to yourself. So be true to your core values and what you consider at the core of your value system. Because what I have found is that, or what I have seen is that, like, the system or in the environment can be so harsh to you that you even end up changing, or you end up being the person that you actually didn't want to be. And so if you're true to yourself, even if there are challenges, you always be rooted in your core principles, and you'll be able to actually flourish within those value systems, and not like look back and be like, who am I? Like, because what the reason why I say that is, sometimes what happens is that because women are always fighting, whether just to get equal pay or fighting to be recognized, sometimes that can be exhausting, and sometimes you become the mean person that you didn't want to actually be. And so that can actually discourage the next girl who's trying to also come into the system. So be true to your principles, and persevere through the challenges, and you definitely make it through.
That advice like totally resonates with me so much, because one of the things that I have found as I have gotten older, and I've talked about it a bit on the podcast, is that so like when I started out in my career, not in school, but in my career, I hid like more feminine traits and tried to be one of the guys and to fit in. And the older I get, the more regretful I am about that, because to your point, like, it's so important to be what I call like your authentic self, you know, mm-hmm. and be able to be who you are. And like, why would I ever think that it was a bad thing to be a girl and an engineer, right? You know, or a girl and a scientist, a girl and an astrophysicist. Like, we should be mm-hmm. celebrating it, not hiding it. And I hope, you know, this was 30 years ago that I started my career. I hope that, and I think that this has changed. I don't think girls are hiding that as much and trying to like, you know, fit in. I think it definitely has changed, but it's something I'm so regretful of, because we bring so much more when we are our true selves.
That's very true. That's true.
Well, I thank you so much for being on the podcast. I am so glad that I got to meet you, and maybe at some point, if I get to go back to South Africa, maybe I can meet you in person, which would be absolutely awesome. So thank you for being on, and I wish you the best now in whatever you do. And I hope that you'll stay in touch. And if there's anything that I can do to help with outreach and stuff, I think I think it's so important, especially, you know, with girls that have like less opportunities. It's so important to be able to let them see what they can be, and representation matters so much.
That's true. Thank you so much for extending the invitation. And I think the conversation that we had was definitely an important one that I hope that will make a change, even if it's to one person. And thank you so much for offering to help with outreach. I'll definitely be in touch, because once the COVID situation calms down, I'll be doing a lot of outreach. So I'll be in touch, definitely.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Ordinarily Extraordinary Conversations with Women in STEM. You can find a list of definitions, acronyms, and a fact check in the episode notes. If you like this podcast, please like it and write a review. And if you'd like to have more episodes delivered right to you, please feel free to hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcast platform. And please join me for future episodes. Thank you.